the Threefold Lotus Sutra, because I walked out the house without my Jean Rhys translation. But no, you guys follow along. It's not that much different, right? You know, so it's okay. So the chapter we're looking at tonight is chapter 5, the parable of the herbs. We will have an herb garden here, and a flower garden, and a vegetable garden. So it's appropriate. Maybe we'll have a tiny little lotus pond too. Maybe we'll have that. That'd be nice. So at that time, the world-honored one addressed Mahakashyapa and the other great disciples. Good, good, Kashyapa. You have well proclaimed the real merits of the Tathagata. Truly, they are, as you have said, the Tathagata, in addition, has infinite, boundless, innumerable merits, which, if you spoke for an infinite kotis of kalpas, you could not fully express. No, Kashyapa, the Tathagata is the king of the law. Whatever he declares is wholly free from falsity. He expounds all the laws by wise tactfulness. The law preached by him all leads to the stage of perfect knowledge. The Tathagata sees and knows what is the good of all the laws, and also knows what all living beings in their inmost hearts are doing. He penetrates them without hindrance. Moreover, in regard to all laws, having the utmost understanding of them, he reveals to all living beings the wisdom of perfect knowledge. Kashyapa, suppose in the 3,000 great thousandfold world, there are growing on the mountains, along the rivers and streams, in the valleys and on the land, plants, trees, thickets, forests, and medicinal herbs of various and numerous kinds, with names and colors all different. A dense cloud spreading over and everywhere, covering the whole 3,000 great thousand-fold world, pours down its rain equally at the same time. Its moisture universally fertilizes the plants, trees, thickets, forests, and medicinal herbs. And with their teeny roots, teeny stalks, teeny twigs, teeny leaves, their medium-sized roots, medium stalks, medium twigs, medium leaves, their big roots, big stalks, big twigs, big leaves, every tree, big or little, according to its superior, middle, or lower capacity, receives its share. From the rain of the one cloud, each according to the nature of its kind, acquires its development, opening its blossoms and bearing its fruit. Though produced in one soil and moistened by the same rain, yet these plants and trees are all different. No, Kashyapa, the Tathagata is also like this. He appears in the world like the rising of that great cloud. Universally, he extends his great call over the world of gods, men, and asuras, just as that great cloud everywhere covers the 3,000 great thousandfold region. In the great assembly, he sounds forth these words: I am the Tathagata, the worshipful, the all-wise, the perfectly enlightened in conduct, the well-departed, the understander of the world, the peerless leader, the controller, the teacher of gods and men, the Buddha, the world-honored one. Those who have not yet been saved, I cause to be saved. Those who have not yet been set free, to be set free. Those who have not yet been comforted, to be comforted. Those who have not yet obtained nirvana, to obtain nirvana. I know the present world and the world to come as they really are. I am the all-knowing, the all-seeing, knower the way, the opener of the way, the preacher of the way. Come to me, all you gods, men, and asuras, and hear the law. At that moment, numberless thousand myriad kotis of classes of living beings came to the Buddha to hear the law. Thereupon the Tathagata, observing the natural powers of these beings, keen or dull, zealous or indifferent, according to their capacity, preached to them the law in various and unstinted ways, causing them all to rejoice and joyfully obtain much profit. All these living beings, having heard the law and are comforted in the present life and afterwards, will be born in happy states, where they will be made joyful by the truth and also hear the law. Having heard the law, they will be freed from hindrances according to their capacity, and all the laws, they gradually enter the way. Just as that great cloud raining on all the plants, trees, thickets, forests, and medicinal herbs, and according to the nature of their seed, perfectly fertilizing them so each grows and develops, so the law preached by the Tathagata is of one form and flavor, that is to say, deliverance, abandonment, extinction, and finally the attainment of perfect knowledge. If there be living beings who hear the law of the Tathagata and keep, read, recite, and practice it as it is preached by him, their achievements will not enable them to understand their own nature. Wherefore? Because there is only the Tathagata who knows the seed, the form, the embodiment, and the nature of all these living things, living beings, what things they are reflecting over, what things they are thinking, what things practicing, how reflecting, how thinking, how practicing, and by what laws reflecting, and by what laws thinking, by what laws practicing, and by what laws attaining to what laws. There is only the Tathagata who in reality sees, clearly and without hindrance, the stages in which all living beings are, just as those plants, trees, thickets, forests, medicinal herbs, and others do not know their own natures, superior, middle, or inferior. The Tathagata knows this unitary essential law, that is to say, deliverance, abandonment, extinction, final nirvana of eternal tranquility, ending in return to the void. The Buddha, knowing this and observing the dispositions of all beings, supports and protects them. For this reason, he does not immediately declare to them the complete and perfect wisdom. Kashyapa, all of you, a most rare thing it is that you should be able to know the law preached by the Tathagata as he sees fit, and be able to believe and able to receive it. Wherefore? Because the law preached by the Buddhas, the world-honored one, as they see fit, is difficult to discern and difficult to know. One of the shorter chapters, it's of course put again in verse form a little bit different, the parable of the herbs. We need a garden so that we can see different flowers, different herbs, different vegetables will spring up just from the one earth, right? That's good to see that. So hopefully we'll be getting the gardening committee together soon. We have some ideas, and then we raise the money, and then we create the garden. So it's very important for temples to have gardens and to see things growing, because the nature of the Dharma is seed and sprout and flower. It's that easy. So Flower Ornament Sutra, the flowers are the basic metaphor for our Buddha practice, isn't it? Isn't it nice to know that it's that easy? Just plant a garden, feed others. So it's interesting where if we just add the earth and add the right amount of water, each flower will come up according to its own nature, each herb, each vegetable. So everyone here, maybe, which one of you are herbs, flowers, or vegetables? No one wants to be a vegetable. Actually, I like carrots. Brussels sprouts. Yeah. Lima beans. Ginger? Yeah. Ginger. So we need the flowers, we need the herbs, we need the vegetables. We need weeds too. Yeah. Dandelions, I don't know. We can eat dandelions. What else are weeds we can use? Crabgrass, yeah, we need crabgrass. Thistles. Yeah. Pansies, yeah. Blackberries. Yeah, blackberries, like the river. There you go. We need flowers that are in the front. People walk in. We have flowers that, you know, because of efforts, Roberta and others putting together the flowers here. We have Trader Joe's to thank too, right? Yeah. So, and then maybe some kind of flowers or nice bushes. Some color along the parking lot, don't you think? Something. Yeah. Yeah, I like rose bushes myself, you know. Some they're poppies. Yeah. Oh, poppies are California poppies. What kind? Yeah. So we have a Bodhi tree. It just happens to be an orange tree. It's an orange Bodhi tree. We've already named it the orange Bodhi tree, yeah. I don't know if you can we can plant a whole bunch of things. So the gardens need to be beautiful, and then we need a tea pergola, deck and pergola. So we have to actually see, we have to see the seeds, we have to see the seeds go in the earth, we have to see the watering, we have to see the flowering, we have to then, you know, eat that. We have to see the whole cycle, because if we don't see these kind of things, then we don't actually know how the meditation works properly. It's not a metaphor. I know, it sounds like, well, that's a metaphor, and then the mind works differently. No, but it actually just works like that. So the metaphors of Dharma are, you know, we have some warrior metaphors, and we, you know, which is mostly for the attainment and the path. But the metaphor for Buddhahood is the flowers. They'll come from flowers. Padmasambhava born from lotus, right? Lotus born. Who's been to India and seen big lotuses? Yeah, really big. Yeah, then you can see how it's possible to sit on a lotus. Yeah. All the practices that we do after the basic shamatha practice, basic mindfulness practice, are based on you know, a change in our fundamental consciousness. So once we start doing even Vipassana, let alone Mahavipassana, let alone Yidam practice, then you know, we can sit on lotuses, of course, because we have different bodies. So the deity bodies, the devas, the light, you know, luminous qualities, you know, that's what we're doing the practice primarily with. This luminous mind. What's the luminous mind called sometimes? Some students here that I know. What do we sometimes call luminous mind? Clear light, yeah. So, you know. So to actually, you know, do meditation on the flowers and gardens and lakes is really important. So sometimes we need to do like walking retreat along the river, or sit by the pond at Lotus View Ranch when we do the Mahamudra and Dzogchen practice. We didn't really sit looking at the pond too much. We kind of, but we'll do that this time. Yeah. A little bit, yeah. So Milarepa there's poems in Milarepa's songs where Milarepa can hide. There was a snowstorm and Milarepa could hide in the yak horn. Okay. So in the yak horn, neither got smaller or bigger, and Milarepa neither got smaller or bigger. Like the other, well, yesterday Renee said, oh, these are like Zen koans. These are pith instructions, something to meditate on. So Milarepa was able to be inside the yak horn, and he neither got smaller or the yak horn got bigger. How do you do that? This is a real practice thing. So once we leave the shamatha world, even then, once we've received an impairment, if you people here received even basic impairment, like even Kriya Yoga beginning, you know, we just visualize Medicine Buddha or Chenrezig in front, then at least be sitting on a lotus flower, right? I know we have a nice kind of cush, but you want to actually, you know, feel like sitting on lotus flower, isn't that right? Or at least you're sitting on kusha grass. When you do retreat, sometimes you sit on kusha grass, and then maybe people don't know, but traditional is you'd sit on swastika, right? Or something might. Or if you're doing Vajrayogini, maybe sitting on that. But, you know, you have to create that kind of imaginal world where it doesn't work. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Ordinary mind is dualistic mind. Dualistic mind says, you know, I can't fit in the, I can't fit on a lotus, or I can't fit inside the yak horn. So we have to start training right away. Don't wait until you know, we say we're doing Mahamudra Dzogchen to start thinking, well, I'll train in ordinary mind, and then once I get that perfect, then I'll switch over to do non-dual meditation. It's impossible. You won't get there. So you already, even when we start basic practice, you have to consider that things are very weird. That's not so hard, is it? Huh? No.
I just hope not.
I hope not, yeah. So when we're doing the parable of the herbs, there's an inner meaning here too. It isn't just like metaphor that, you know, the Buddha's just kind of doing flowers. They're talking about a lived experience. That makes sense, right?
Yeah, like that. Yeah, like that.
We're inside it. We're inside the experience. If you're inside the experience, you can fit in. If you're inside of your experience, you can fit in a horn, or you can sit on a lotus if you're inside your experience.
Have you ever seen someone crawl inside a horn or sit on a lotus?
Yes, of course. But, so when you say, as an outside experience, I mean, scientific outside?
Sure.
Yeah. See, but we're not talking about the outside experience.
But the self inside there.
Yeah.
We're assuming that the body then survives the blizzard. But the mind, I mean.
Okay. So when you... when we talk about, thank you. So when we're talking about lotuses and gardens, we're not talking about experience from the dualistic side already.
Well, he was already in the horn anyway, so there's no work.
Yeah, there's nothing literal about it, actually. That's the problem. There's nothing literal about it.
Well, you said it's not metaphorical either.
Yeah, it's not metaphorical either. It's not literal dualistic, and it's not metaphor, because all those kinds of things are talked about from accepting the world of dualism. Then we try to explain how miracles or how non-dual mind could manifest. And you can't really do it. You have to kind of leap into the non-dual world and then talk from that place. And then you can say, could you join me on the flower? Or would you like to join me in the yak horn? I think Milarepa's student Rachungpa tried to join him or something and got stuck or something.
How can you talk from that place by definition that makes it dualistic?
When you're talking from that place, then it's not dualistic.
Just talking. There's not even me talking at that point. It's just talking.
There could be, there's a non-dualistic me.
Yeah.
If you say, please, please meet me in the place where we both love each other. That's neither literal nor metaphoric. That's a place that can't be measured and can't be seen by the outside world, but can be seen by the inside world. So in that place, you can meet, you see.
Since I'm stuck in the dualistic mind,
I take this. Well, you also want to make it experience, because right now everyone in the room has experiences from the non-dual place. If you've ever been in love, or you've ever even just fallen asleep, the dualistic world disappears and the non-dual world appears, and we speak from that place. It's happening all the time. Well, we're not appreciating it, yeah. So we're kind of going, we're not seeing it as important. It's interesting. Even just simple things, it's like if you just say, gee, that's really neat. We agree on that, You can't see that agreement, right? You can't see it as an object. You might have the same content. We both agree that the sky is blue, but you can't see that. Oh, we both agree. Right? You can't see that world. Right? Oh, gosh, we have... So nice, we both are, you know, people sometimes say, we're on the same page. I see what you're saying. I'm so glad to see you. You know, can't see that world, right? It's the inner world.
I can only hope that listening to that Dharma will stop my mind.
It does. It stops your mind because it's awe, you know, like you see a flower or you fall in love with someone or, you know, just see a beautiful sunset, and then that world of connection you can't see from the outside because it's dualistic, but you can appreciate it. So the real world is the world, the non-dual world, because that's the world that means anything, the world that we just kind of go, oh my goodness, that's the real world, right? Rain comes down, flowers open up. Yes. Yes.
Doesn't that tend to then take you to a dualistic place where you're tempted and you want that becomes not that real world anymore? And if that's the case, then how do you stay in a more expansive place where that doesn't?
Yes, that's the right question. So what we're doing is we're training to continually notice that place, which has to generally be pointed out to us, and then we interrupt the dualistic world. We kind of interrupt it a little bit. So you know, even interrupt the interrupt world, you know, so even in shamatha practice, we notice, you know, we catch ourselves drifting, right? So that's interrupting the interrupted world, right? The drifting is a little bit dualistic. Yeah, so then we go, oh, I'm drifting. And then, you know, actually just noticing your drifting is just a teeny little piece of, like, you know, Yeshen Rigpa. We're just kind of just a little spark, right? And then we go back to our technique. But the important part is it's more like we're recognizing we're drifting. And if we recognize that recognizing we're drifting, then we're beginning to develop that Mahamudra and Dzogchen place.
See that sometimes as a metronome in my head, and that recognizing that I'm drifting is just a tiny bump off the center. If I don't make a deal, I just recognize it, and it's just a tiny bump off the center. I can see I'm off the center, and then it, you know,
yeah,
comes back real quick.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be big, you know. So that's the wonderful thing about our practice is when we're dwelling, or we use that term, we're dwelling in a state of Rigpa, it's there. And then when we go off, it's there too. I mean, that's the complete joy of the full flowering, is that you can't go wrong. It's just the most incredible thing. You like, even, you know, it's like, you know, you can't lose. It's just amazing. When you're just in that place, then you're there. Even if you drift off, you immediately notice you've drifted off. And know, even if you don't immediately know, you will notice. So it's kind of like you can't lose. It's an incredible feeling of freedom. You kind of go, oh my gosh, it's great, you know.
I think I understand. I think I generally have faith now because I screw up as much as I ever have.
Yeah.
But I'm kind of okay with it now because I think I have that faith.
Well, we know, you know, this kind of appreciation, we can screw up and then come back into balance, but we do have to be present. We do have to be present at that moment. We have to notice, okay, not only that we notice we're drifting, we're caught in the emanations of mind, we're kind of caught in the waves. Even though it's display, we get caught in it, and then we have to notice how we have to notice the noticing of it and return, you know, back to rest. So there is some operation there. You know, we're not, when we're on the path, we're still not just in a continual state of pure awareness. But there's a feeling that even though, you know, like you might drift and a little bell goes off, you know, and you get to appreciate that. But we have to be present for it. It's kind of an automatic process, but it's not entirely automatic.
Well, it's not something you can do.
We can do it.
Waiting for grace.
No, we can do it. We're not waiting. We're training ourselves to notice when we drift, and we're training ourselves to notice that the noticing itself is primordially pure. So there's actually two operations going on there. I'm sorry, we're giving kind of advanced talk, but this is just yogi shop talk, you know. So I mean, we just
kind of
why. It's not the watcher watching, because at this point it's you know it's more intimate than that, because it's not mechanical. Yeah, the metaphor is kind of more towards flowers opening up to the sun, or lovers, or you know, it's reciprocal, it's interactional, but it's not watching. You know, it's more like dancing. That's why. Watching tends to be dualistic, but introspection and Shaishin and Tibetan it's participatory. You see, you know, like no one likes to be watched and kind of like beware watching, but you know, someone likes to know that you're being attentive, right? So that's different than, you know. You know, if you have lunch with your friend, you know, it would feel creepy if you're kind of like watching. But you know, at the same time, your friend's going to want you to be attentive and notice, right? Because one's participatory and one's a little bit got an edge, a judgment to it, right? You're waiting for something to go wrong, kind of in watching, but in introspection or Shaishin, more fully present. It's interactive. Pardon me? Well, you are there. Yeah, you want to be there. So we do want to catch ourselves in the act of being ourselves, you know, like that. It's easy. So that's why watching plants grow and didn't anybody ever be in kindergarten where they kind of send you back with some bean sprouts? And did you ever? Huh? Yeah. And then you kind of like, yeah, you just sit there and go, okay. And then your mom or dad says, it's time to go to bed now. You know, I used to do that. So I came home with a bean sprout, and I just put it in front of me. And okay. Has anybody ever like put a saucepan and then turn on the heat to watch it boil? That's important. You should watch. That's an important metaphor for meditation. Okay, they will say watch by never. No, we do that. So yeah, you want to watch that process. You see,
it does boil.
yeah. It's like that. Little bubbles, and then, you know, the steam. So these, you know, we do have to plant flowers. We do have to watch water boil. We do have to watch the rain fall. You know, otherwise, it's going to be very difficult to do the higher level meditations, let alone the beginning ones, because we're talking in Tantra about, you know, the you know, the drops falling down or the drops rising up. So if you never watch any fire, you know, you won't get the idea of these little sparks coming up, right? You know, that's the problem with technology. You know, if we just kind of turn on the electrical heat or something, you know, and, you know, you're reading the tantras where it says, you know, just kind of the little sparks will fly up the central channel. If you don't actually know what little sparks flying up, you won't get it. We actually, you know, you have to actually, like, do it. That's important, right? We need the flowers, but it's still an inside. It becomes an inside thing. It's doable. It's doable. Do we need to stretch for a minute before we do the meditation? So, in the correct way to approach Lotus Sutra, we're both the Bodhisattva. We're actually all the characters in the sutra. Of course, we're the Shravakas that don't get it, and we're the Bodhisattvas, and we're the Buddha too. We have to be able to take those different positions, right? So it's dualistic practice if we just say, well, we're just Shravakas, or we're just Bodhisattvas, or we're just the Buddha. So we have to be able to be both the flower and the gentle rain. Not the Houston rain, just gentle rain, right? Poor people, it's so difficult. So the meditation, the inner meditations is you want to be, you know, the flower and the cloud and the gentle rain, right? You want to be all of that, the Buddha and the Bodhisattva and the Shravaka, like that. So if you're just doing the imaginal world, you know, you want to, you know, say to your friend, meet me in that garden where the flower, you know, they feel like they're getting nourished, right? Don't you want to say that to your friend, like, meet me in that garden, right? That's the best. So, but to develop that inner experience, we use our imagination, which is part of the non-dual world. So we're the garden. You could visualize a garden here, or a garden where you've been, or just when the sun hits the lotus just right and it opens up. Wouldn't you like to be a garden? Yeah. Don't be a human being. Don't you ever get tired of being human beings? Don't you want to be a garden? Yeah. Okay. So this time be, you know, like, what was the nutcracker sweet? Is the dance of the flowers? The flower? The dance. Yeah, waltz of the flowers. Yeah, there's a music. Yeah, something like that. You want to be the flower? Do you know? Kids know how to do it. So let's meet there. Let's meet in that garden. Okay.